the Journey to Wellness podcast. I'm so excited to have you here today to share about your journey with food and what you've learned. And I think we'll just start off with just having you introduce who you are, kind of what you do.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. So I am just a normal mom of three kids, and I do have a passion for holistic health and nutrition. And it kind of all started back when I got diagnosed with Crohn's disease in 11th grade in 2009. And then it evolved from there. That's kind of what I guess would have initially triggered my interest with diet. I had to drastically change my diet back then. And then over the years, it just evolved more and more as I learned to live with my Crohn's and other health issues that I was struggling with. And then over the years, I've become very passionate about the dietary side of things and how that can impact your health. And so I've become a nerd in the kitchen.
And that's how I kind of got to introduce or have you come on here, is because I follow you on Instagram, and just watching you in the kitchen, you can just tell that like you're very passionate, like you said, passionate about what you're cooking and what you're bringing into your kitchen, and even for your kids too. It kind of goes across your entire household, which yes. is super inspiring.
Yeah. I feel like, well, initially, like I just cared about eating healthy for my Crohn's. But over the years, I started realizing how that impacts your emotional, hormonal, physical health, all of the things that, you know, it affects every part of your life, not just, you know, what I used to do was eat a certain way to keep my Crohn's in remission. And so I've become more passionate about the nutritional side of things rather than just trying to keep inflammation at bay.
Yeah. So if we could just kind of take us back to when you first got diagnosed, was eating differently a drastic change right away, or did it take some time of learning like what works, what doesn't, in that initial stage?
So initially I got diagnosed, maybe this is TMI, but I was 16 or 17 years old, had a whole year of blood in my stools, didn't tell my mom about it because, you know, I was at that age where I was so embarrassed, and finally told her when I started getting pretty severe stomach pain, and passing more blood. And so she brought me in, and I had a stomach ulcer and then different forms of inflammation throughout my intestines. And so initially they put me on a high dose of prednisone to get the inflammation down. And, I had pretty severe side effects for that. I couldn't walk for a couple of weeks. It affected my joints. It hurt to lay, hurt to walk, hurt to do anything. So they slowly weaned me off that and put me on another medication. And then I started getting rashes on my face and my hair started falling out. So they put me on a third medication and it started affecting my liver. So they took me off that. And at that point, my mom had already brought me to my Aunt Myra. And she was the one who initiated the first dietary changes. So I was on a very drastic diet. I got diagnosed in June, and by August, I was on a very strict diet. And we were kind of doing like a form of the elimination diet, where I eliminated all of these things, gluten, dairy, greasy foods, nuts, raw vegetables, and then slowly added them in after a few months. And I struggled a lot with that because you couldn't go and buy a gluten-free loaf of bread from the grocery store. My mom had to order specific blends of or flours from food buying clubs and then blend her own flour. And so that part was really hard because there wasn't a lot of options of what I could eat, but my mom did all the work for me. So looking back, I'm like, it was hard for me because I had to eat differently and I felt embarrassed being around people bringing my cooler everywhere I went. But I also wasn't the one who had to prep all the food. But I struggled, I would say, with the dietary aspect of it, changing my diet that drastically at an age where I didn't want to change my diet. I struggled with that for two or three years, probably going back and forth to eating where I felt good, but not enjoying the food. And then going back to eating things I shouldn't eat and dealing with the inflammation. So that did go on for several years until eventually I started realizing that I just needed to make a permanent lifestyle change.
Yeah. Yeah. So at that time when you were doing the elimination diets, did you understand that like certain foods cause more inflammation, or was it just like, well, this is what they're telling me to do, this is what I have to do to help my gut?
I would say it was more just I was doing what I was told to do. Mm-hmm. And then over those few years, I would keep food journals occasionally. And over those few years, I started realizing how food affected me. Yeah. It was through a lot of trial and error and then acceptance in the end. And mm-hmm. from there, it turned into a really positive experience. Awesome. But the first few years were tough. I was simultaneously dealing with an eating disorder.
Okay.
So, and that started when I was in fifth grade. Oh. I didn't know it at the time that I had an issue, but I was dealing with that at the same time. So the drastic dietary change was, I think, even a little harder just because I already had a poor relationship with food. But yeah, so eventually I did learn what foods affected me, but it was a lot of trial and error.
Yeah. Do you mind if we go into that relationship with food thing?
Yeah.
Where do you think, do you know where that, like, have you dug into that and like know where that stems from? Or?
Yeah, I've thought about it, and I think it's several things. I couldn't say specifically why it started. I remember when my body dysmorphia started, in fifth grade, I remember wearing a bathing suit and jumping off of a bridge and having someone take a picture of me jumping off the bridge. But I remember I had to put my hands up in the air so then my belly would look thinner. So that's like my first memory of feeling self-conscious and having kind of that twisted image of what I looked like. But as far as like where I started restricting food was around that same time. But I think growing up with parents, and not absolutely not blaming my parents at all, but a lot of parents in my generation were part of the diet culture. Mm-hmm. And that's just what was pushed onto them. Mm-hmm. And so I was always around people who were going on the scales and on certain diets, and they had certain food they could eat. And so I think it was just part of growing up, I was exposed to a lot of that. And it wasn't at all like I was put on a diet, but I was watching that happen. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that was part of the reason, is that then I started looking at my body and thinking, do I have to go on a diet? You know, going through puberty and middle school, especially, like, you know, when you care so much what people think of you, and then your body is going through so many changes that you don't understand. I started feeling like I had to go on a diet. And honestly, my friends and stuff would go on diets as well. And I don't think anyone even understood what the diets were. It was just, you know, I don't know. I think it was just a trending thing at that time.
Yeah. Well, it's what you do. It's what everybody
else
is doing.
Yeah.
What your moms are doing. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
It's so interesting, like how what we see in our environments then completely shapes us, even if that's not something we need to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it wasn't even anybody's fault. It was just what I observed. And mm-hmm. so, you know, one of those things that looking back, I'm like, I couldn't have really done anything to avoid that. Mm-hmm. It was just what I guess I had to go through. Yeah. And in the end, it ended up, you know, working out. You go through something hard and you learn a lot and you have a lot of appreciation in the end for yeah. certain things that maybe you wouldn't have before.
Mm-hmm. How has your relationship changed with food since then? Do you think like the Crohn's and kind of going through that, like eating food that wasn't great for your body and then going back and eating the good stuff, and that whole journey helped you appreciate or changing, did that help change your relationship with food overall? Or how did that, those two things end up tying together or not really?
They did. So when I initially got diagnosed with my Crohn's, I was 17, and those first few years I would use my diet for my Crohn's as an excuse to not eat at certain places. I would almost like weaponize it against myself, you know, to have an excuse to use my, you know, for my eating disorder that people didn't know I had. So it was a very good excuse, to kind of get away with that or be under the radar. And so once I'm trying to think of like when the shift would have happened, I would have started, in 2012, I believe, is when I initially was introduced to the Gerson therapy, which is a natural cancer treatment through juicing and coffee enemas. I watched a documentary called The Beautiful Truth and then I got a juicer and I started diving into that. But at that time, I was still full on struggling with bulimia. I didn't recognize I had an eating disorder, but I was super interested and fascinated with healing the body naturally. Mm-hmm. And so I started watching more documentaries and reading more books. And so I would say my relationship with food started improving in that aspect. I started understanding what food can do for the body, but didn't recognize I had an issue. Once I got treated for my eating disorder, about a year after I was, or no, I would say I was introduced to the Gerson therapy in the summer of 2011 and spring of 2012, I was hospitalized for my eating disorder. So I would say that's when the shift would have kind of happened, is after I was hospitalized and realized, okay, I do have an issue. I struggled for a good 3 years still with my eating disorder, going in and out of remission of using my symptoms or not. But once I met my husband, he really was the one who helped me kind of get over the body dysmorphia. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of work. But then I started, once in 2015 is the last time I used my symptoms and with my eating disorder. And that's when I really started changing my focus to nourishing my body and not going on any extreme diets. And, I would say from there, it's been a slow journey of changing my perspective on food. I always looked at it as food is weight loss or weight gain. And so that was a very slow shift, I would say.
Yeah. And so now the shift is from looking at your body as, or as food as weight loss or weight gain, the shift is it nourishes you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
It can have a really beautiful effect depending on what you're feeding your body.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And not looking at, like, obviously, you know, naturally you look at junk food or fast food or ultra processed food as bad food, but not carrying the guilt when you consume that food, because we're all human, we're all going to indulge. Mm-hmm. I would say those are the things over the past probably 4 or 5 years that I've really had to work on, not demonizing any food, even if it is the junk food, even if you're going out for ice cream or going out, you know, for a meal at a fast food restaurant. Like, all food is food, even if it's junk food, and demonizing it or demonizing a certain food group, the stress or the guilt that comes with consuming the food and having that, that negative relationship with it is worse than just consuming the food and enjoying it. And obviously there's a fine line of, you know, you want to take care of yourself, but you also don't want to be so strict and so rigid that you can't enjoy some junk food once in a while. You know, I started realizing that the stress that's tied to eating junk food, when you feel the guilt, is worse than just eat the cookie and enjoy it, you know?
Yeah. And then that along with like the whole 80-20 idea of just like, yeah, 80% of the time you want to take care of your body, making sure that you're eating well. And we can talk about what that looks like in a little bit, but, you know, 20, or maybe it's less for some people, but some percentage of the time you're just going to go out for ice cream with your family and enjoy that experience.
Yes.
Have you dove into German New Medicine at all?
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So German New Medicine is this idea I might botch this a little bit, but it's, so if we have a trauma in the body, or we'll have a conflict, and if we don't fully resolve that conflict, it can get stuck in the body and create disease. And so one of the things is like her idea with food, allergens or whatnot is like, if we're eating something at the time of a conflict and that conflict happens, we might then react to that food. And it's like our body's innate way of, of like protecting us. And this is like a very glossed over. So they believe that there's 5 biologic rules and, or yeah, rules and all these things. But it's interesting because I've done like a lot of testing with like, why am I allergic to certain foods? And some of them being like my favorite foods through, whether it's like wellness weight testing or whatnot. And that makes sense to me that like, if I'm making something bad when I'm eating it, then my body is responding with a stress response. Mm-hmm. And their whole idea is that the body is innately intelligent and it just responds to like our thoughts and what we're putting into it. And the experience we're having with those, you know, so if you're beating yourself up the whole time, then your body's going to be like, oh, this food is bad. I can't, you know, like, and then inflame even more instead of like, oh, thank you for serving me. And this is delicious. And it's, you know, like, it's like a whole different relationship and our body completely responds so differently to it.
It makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Stress has a much bigger impact on the body than I think people realize. And people think of stress as like you're anxious or, you know, something like that. But it's like, there's so many different forms of stress mm-hmm. and not just being anxiety or being physically stressed out. And that's probably maybe the most common form of stress, but you know, there's, yeah, you might not even realize that you're just subconsciously stressed out all the time. I had an experience after my dad died. I was eating very clean at the time. He died in 2016. So I was doing well for about a year with my eating disorder at that time. And I remember when he died, worrying about myself and how I was going to cope with that because I had never coped well with emotional situations in the past. That was my biggest struggle, were these emotional struggles over the years. And I ended up surprising myself with how well I was able to cope with his death. And I took care of myself through it. And my boyfriend at the time, now husband, forced me to talk through it in a very healthy way. And I ended up still struggling with my Crohn's and digestive issues. And I was like, what is going on? Like, I'm doing okay. I'm eating very well. And I'm still now having issues. And I think it's because obviously, you know, subconsciously I was stressed out and I missed my dad. And I had, you know, this probably, you know, whatever you want to call it, this emotional struggle internally that I was I was doing better than I thought. So I didn't realize I was hurting, you know, and it just goes to show that, you know, it doesn't matter how well you're doing in all of the other areas of life. If you're stressed out, like your body can only heal so much. And, you know, the importance of taking care of yourself in that way and being able to try and recognize when your plate is too full, which is something I'm still learning, you know?
Yeah, it's a constant work in progress.
It's a constant work in progress, yes.
So what does your food intake, or like what's your kind of goal with food nowadays? So like when I guess from my perspective, like what I see is like you're eating clean in the sense of like, I think everybody's definition of clean can be different, right? Mm-hmm. It looks like whole foods, a lot of fruit, meats. What's your goal right now with eating? Like what's, if you can kind of overarch it, I guess.
So I would say the past maybe 4 years, since I've had a big shift on my perspective on food, is my diet is a lot more inclusive now than it was before. I've just learned the importance of properly preparing each food. So I was gluten-free on and off for many, many years. I've successfully introduced grains back into my diet through initially buying sprouted grain bread. And then eventually that evolved into doing sourdough and long fermenting sourdough. I still don't do well with corn, beans, the heavier starchy foods like that, but also I haven't experimented with properly preparing those. Vegetables, I would say I don't do a lot of raw vegetables. If I do vegetables, I cook them in animal fat to make them more bioavailable, easier to digest, breaking down the anti-nutrients in them that can affect people differently. So I would say my grains, I've learned to soak, sprout, ferment, and vegetables, I like to ferment cabbage to make sauerkraut. Dairy, I've introduced raw dairy probably about 4-ish years ago, started introducing dairy back into my diet. So I make a lot of raw kefir, raw yogurt, drink a lot of raw dairy. And then I would say, yeah, tons of fruit. We eat a lot of fruit and a lot of meat. I would say my diet now is very animal-based. Mm-hmm. The easiest for our bodies to recognize and process. And then I've tried to slowly transition to eating what's in season. So looking back to the way that maybe our grandparents or great-grandparents would have eaten, they would have eaten a lot of warm foods in the winter. They would have done a lot of stews and a lot of roasts, and the vegetables they would have eaten would have been a lot of roots and a lot of anything that can be stored in a root cellar, you know, onions, carrots, potatoes, squashes. And then, you know, they would ferment their food. So they would ferment, they would make pickles, they would make sauerkraut, they would pickle beets, they would pickle carrots, pickle onions, all the things to preserve those. And then in the summer, or I guess sourdough bread, things like that. In the summer, there's a lot more, there's an abundance of berries and I guess whatever, depending on what region you're in. But so I feel like that's been more my focus the past few years, is just eating seasonally. I don't eat a lot of lettuce in the winter, but in the summer, I crave salads every once in a while. And so I guess, I mean, that's always going to be a process of refining my diet, you know, with what I have the capacity to do at the time. But that's kind of my overall focus, is looking, how did our great-grandparents eat? Yeah. And, you know, my great-grandparents would have been from Finland. They would have a similar climate to here. So it's, you know, kind of the perfect place to live to try and mimic the way our ancestors would have eaten. And I chuckle sometimes, because for so many years I was like, oh, Finnish people, they just eat meat and potatoes. Like, it's such a boring diet. And it's kind of going full circle. And now I'm kind of the meat and potatoes person. I eat a lot of meat and I eat a lot of roots.
Yeah. And it's also so simple, right? And as a parent, it's like meat and potatoes. It's simple.
Yeah. It is. And it doesn't have to be complicated. And I think for so many years, I got sucked into the trending health foods, where you're trying to make pizza with a cauliflower crust, or, you know, you're trying to make a brownie that's made out of black beans and things like that, where it's like, you can make delicious foods with simple ingredients the way that they used to. And turns out they're very good for you. But I feel like grains have gotten demonized over the years, or especially grains. Sugar has gotten demonized. And granted, sugar, if you're going to go and eat spoonfuls of sugar, isn't good for you. But if you're having it in a balanced way with protein and fat, sugar is not a bad food. That's a food that's been around for a very long time. And sure, you can overconsume it, but I feel like, once again, just like demonizing the food groups. And a lot of it is probably, you know, a way that they can market their food and make money off of it. But go back to the meat and potatoes and the sourdough and, you know, the simple foods. And they really are the most satiating as well. And that's kind of been my goal over the past few years, is trying to simplify the foods that I eat.
Yeah. There's a few questions I want to kind of circle back to that you've mentioned so much goodness in just that little bit of time. The first thing is sprouting. So sprouting, or like anything that you're doing that way, how is that helping your body? Just for our listeners, you sprout the food, what benefit do you get from that?
Yeah. So when you take just a grain, and if you grind it up and bake it in a bread, say, for example, for somebody that has digestive issues, a grain has a lot of phytic acid in it, which is a form of an anti-nutrient that can kind of, I guess you could say, cause inflammation, because your body can't digest it, but it also can bind to minerals. So you're not only not getting the nutrients that you could out of the grain, it's also could be potentially taking minerals from your body and causing the inflammation. So if you take a grain and you soak it, it sprouts. So technically it's a plant then. And so you're unlocking a lot of nutrition, and you're also neutralizing a lot of the phytic acid that's in the grain. And then if you take it a step further and you ferment it, it takes that a little further and you unlock more nutrition and it becomes a lot more digestible. So technically, if something is sprouted, it's no longer a grain. Okay. It's now a plant. So it's, and then you can do the same thing with rice, with any form of grain. You can do the same with beans, okay, legumes, things like that as well.
So are you just soaking it like overnight?
I've bought sprouted grain bread.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I've bought sprouted spelt flour before. It just isn't feasible for me at this time. So I just soak and ferment my organic flour into a sourdough. But you can do the whole process if you want, you know. Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing is back in the day when wheat would get harvested, a lot of times it was already sprouted. So when they would harvest the wheat, it was already a sprouted wheat. And then they would grind it into a flour, and you couldn't go to the store and buy yeast. So they would have different forms of, they would have liquid yeast. I forget what the name is, but they would ferment their own liquid yeast that they would add into it, into the bread to make it rise. But no matter what they did back then, they had to long ferment the bread. Yeah. In a similar fashion to sourdough. And so it's interesting because the wheat is not the problem. You know, it's a big issue also that I think people don't realize is that oats and wheat, and I'm sure there's other grains, I'm not familiar with all of them, but oats and wheat are heavily sprayed with glyphosate.
Yeah.
Roundup, it's a weed killer. Yeah. Not great for you if you read the bottle. They spray the oats and the wheat with that when they harvest it now to dry it out. So it's another issue that people might not have a problem with wheat itself. It could be that they're sensitive to this chemical. It could be a multitude of issues that people have, but the traditional way is definitely your best bet. And then you could take it a step further and try ancient grains. You could try camu, or you could try einkorn or spelt, or, you know, these different ancient grains, and then try to do the fermenting or the sprouting. It just depends how far you want to go, you know?
Yeah. So basically the idea with the sprouting or buying ancient grains is then they're not sprayed, and then it's more digestible.
100%. Yeah.
And also why we buy organic now too. That's why organic has come so far, is because we don't want our grains sprayed. And I've had this conversation with other people too, is like, maybe you're not allergic or reacting to the wheat. Maybe you're just reacting to what they're spraying on the wheat when they harvest it.
Exactly.
Because then you're directly in taking that into your body. And like you said, glyphosate is not great to intake into your system as a human. So,
and a lot of people have a lot of bread. And even if you say take bread out of the picture, how many other areas of your life that you're having oats or flour? Mm-hmm. It's a huge percentage of people's food intake.
Yeah. I have gone over the last few years more focused on quality of my food because of this purpose. This is kind of where I was wanting to lead. This was like quality over alternatives, I'll say, because like, instead of like getting the oat milk or the, like you said, the cauliflower pizza and all these things, what if we just focused on like quality, like organic, well-made flour that's not sprayed, or sprouted flours, or different things to put in our food versus putting in something that's sprayed down with chemicals.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard because I feel like a lot of people struggle with making the shift because things are more expensive. And I probably take it to the extreme with what I do in the kitchen because it is a passion of mine, and I would never expect somebody to feel like they have to do that. For me though, and my personal health issues, if I were to eat the way I want to eat and purchase the bone broth, purchase the sprouted grain things and the organic, whatever, different things, I wouldn't be able to afford to do that for our entire family. So I've just found ways to purchase the quality in bulk and put in the mm-hmm. work myself in the kitchen, which I've really learned to enjoy. It forces you to slow down. It gives you a greater appreciation for the food that you're consuming. It's very rewarding. And then I know that I'm feeding my family well. And so mm-hmm. it goes beyond just my own health. I'm hoping that my kids get a good head start in their life with their diet and nutrition before they go out in the world and consume all of the foods that teenagers and college students consume. Right. But yeah, it definitely is something that you can't do overnight, and you have to learn all of those things over time and not overwhelm yourself with it. Just take one thing on at a time. But I feel like a lot of people, my friends specifically, that have made changes to make healthier choices for their family have really grown to enjoy the process. Mm-hmm. And some of them thought they would never do it. And here they are, you know, they never had an interest in health, and then they have kids and suddenly it becomes a priority. And it is intimidating, and I still get intimidated with certain things, but I've just learned to kind of dive in and go for it. And then you learn from your mistakes and realize, okay, it's not that bad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have found too, that some things that I've made, like bone broth, for example, I made it to be this big thing in my head, and it's actually not that hard once you do it once or
twice. A lot of the processes are very simple.
Yeah. And so it might look complicated, or like, well, I've never done this, or nobody's ever shown me it. But it's like, that's how we learn, is by like trying once, messing up, trying again, trial and error.
Exactly.
So much of it, like you said, is so, so rewarding to know exactly where it's coming from. And then you start to see how much of like each product you can use. So instead of just like buying, like I buy chickens for my sister-in-law who grows them in Cokato. Now I get the chicken, I make my family chicken, I have leftovers, but then I use those bones to make a bone broth. You're using like the whole animal instead of.
Yeah. It's much more cost effective as well.
Yeah. Very cost effective. And then it's so rewarding to know, like you said, where your food is coming from. And then just the quality of that food, knowing like it came from my sister-in-law's farm and now we're eating it, but we're also using it for the bone broth that I'm using in all of my soups all winter. So fun.
Yeah. Yep.
And same thing. And like, you're kind of known for this on Instagram too, is like with the cow, like you're cooking cow tongue and heart and things that most of us are like,
I should start putting little warnings before I show my stories. Cause I've had some people tell me, they're like, every time that you're cooking a tongue or a heart or whatever it may be, you know, I'm either pregnant or I'm not feeling well. And I get to your stories and I'm like, come on, Jamie, why do you have to do that today? I should really start giving. But to me, I've been doing it for several years where I don't see it as weird anymore. And I know what it's like to look at a tongue for the first time. Believe me, mm-hmm. I gagged the first two times I cooked them. Liver gagged the first several times. I know what it's like to be the person seeing it for the first time and just like, what is that person doing and why would they do that? But same thing with the organ meats, the offal. It's over time, it becomes normal and you start to realize the importance of the organ meats, just as you would say when you're talking about making bone broth with the chicken, using the whole animal. It's rewarding, but it's also the most nutrient dense part of the animal are the parts that are put to the wayside. The bone broth, the bone marrow, the organ meats, the tallow, the lard, the fat from the animal. All of those things are, I think, making a comeback, I would like to think, or maybe it's just because I'm in my own little world over here. Yeah, but I feel like there's a lot more people that are open-minded to all of those things and recognizing the importance, you know, us thinking of, you know, our parents giving us chicken noodle soup when we're sick. It's not just because it's this tradition. It's because the soup is a very soothing and healing food, and it was made of the bones or the meat stock, you know. And granted, Campbell's chicken noodle soup isn't going to have all of those healing qualities, but that's, you know, when you think of like, oh, they, you know, I don't know what your parents did when you had the pukes, but we would get like 7-Up or Sprite or Werner's or something like that. And back in the day, like, soda was a very healthy food, and they would make ginger sodas with a fermenting ginger and sugar, and a similar process to kombucha. But the sodas back then were very healing foods, and it just turned into obviously the 7-Up and the different things, you know, the carbonation. But right. Back in the day, it was because the pop was a healing food. It wasn't considered a junk food. So a lot of the things that we do nowadays, if you look into why we do them, it is very interesting. And you could dive down a deep rabbit hole, you know. Yes, but
definitely.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask about is you also had talked about, I think we talked a little bit about the bioavailability, but that's why we're using more animal fats versus plant fats too.
Yeah.
Because of the minerals and vitamins they have in them, right?
Well, it's, yes, they for sure would have some nutritional value. Absolutely. But the animal fats or fruit fats are natural fats. They're fats that people have consumed since the beginning of time. That's all there was. The things like shortening and Crisco and vegetable oil, and you could list on and on, the cottonseed, canola, corn, safflower, sunflower, soybean, all of these different oils. Those didn't come into our diet until roughly the 60s, the 50s, maybe, the Industrial Revolution. They were, a lot of those things were just byproducts that they realized during the war, byproducts of during the wartime, that they realized that they could profit off of things that they were throwing away. And if they demonized the dairy industry and demonized butter, demonized these different traditional fats, the tallow, the lard, they could make a lot more money off of these byproducts, and ultimately, obviously, ended up totally changing a whole generation's health and view on health, and demonizing, you know, the saturated fats. And yeah. And I feel like there's been a shift, but I feel like a lot of people still see saturated fat as bad. But these other unsaturated, polyunsaturated fats didn't exist,
right.
You know, mm-hmm. until the mid 1900s. So, yeah. So the animal fats do not cause heart disease.
Thank you for the PSA.
It's a bombshell, but
and you don't want to know
heart disease did not exist in the way it does.
Yeah.
You know, in modern times, and that's all they ate was animal fats. And in tropical climates, they would have their coconut oil or their avocado oil. Places that grew olives would have their olive oil, but ultimately tallow, lard, ghee, butter, those were the fats that people consumed. That's all there was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we don't like learning how shortening and those things are made is quite disgusting as well. It kind of goes along with like them spraying the wheat. And that's where that word seed oil comes from, is from these oils that are not meant for us to consume and ultimately create more inflammation in the body.
Yeah, and they truly are void of nutrition as well. Mm-hmm. Like if you take lard, which, you know, pig meat, pig fat is considered like the most unhealthy fat that you could consume. But if you get it from a pasture-raised pig, it is the highest fat in vitamin D, which is so important for our overall health. And you can take vitamin D supplements all day long, but if you're taking these isolated supplements and you're not making sure you're getting the surrounding nutrients that your body needs in order to metabolize it, then you could be cutting yourself short or hurting yourself. Butter, for example, from grass-fed cows, vitamin A, E, D, and K, those aren't found in the margarine. Those aren't found in the Crisco. Mm-hmm. And fish fats as well. I guess I shouldn't leave those out. It's the quality of the animal that you're getting the fats from that is going to give you the nutrition, you know. And not to say that I only consume pasture raised pig. I'll have any bacon, but we do get a half of a pig, and that's the majority of our fat that we do consume from pork. But same thing with tallow. Like it's a delicious, delicious fat to cook with. And even it's interesting, like McDonald's fries are obviously, you know, cooked in seed oils nowadays, but traditionally, like when they first opened, it was cooked in beef tallow, and that's what gave the fries such a good flavor. And now it's cooked in soybean and canola oil, and they add artificial beef flavoring.
Oh, wow.
So it can still have that beef flavor that people love. And so if people get half a cow or get quarter of a cow, ask for the trim fat and cook it down. And there's this lady on YouTube, her account is Bumblebee Apothecary. And she has so many endless videos of rendering fat, cooking and preparing food in traditional ways. And she just has so much information on her YouTube channel. And learn how to render down your own fat. You can do it in a couple of days and have enough fat to last you 6 to 8 months. And it is hard to go back once you cook with butter, tallow, ghee, lard, all of those fats. You go back to having something with margarine in it, and it really doesn't have any flavor.
It doesn't.
And you're also, you know, looking at your food as vitamins. Like, sure, I believe there's a place for supplements, and I supplement my diet in certain ways as well. But ultimately, you should be trying to get that from your food. But if you're not consuming the food that has the vitamins, your body is really going to pay the price at some point.
Right. And that's what bioavailability is being able to get your vitamins from your food, because that's how your body is going to absorb them the best.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah.
So getting them from high quality, like grass-fed meats, pasture-raised, free-range eggs, different things are going to have the highest bioavailability of vitamins and nutrients for our body that we can then, our body knows how to store for us.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. The quality is very important. I guess I will say, if you cannot afford to get pasture-raised chickens and pasture-raised eggs and pastured pork and grass-fed cow, all of the whole foods, whether you're talking about organic vegetables, organic fruit, if you can't afford any of that, it doesn't matter. You're still going to benefit from getting any form of whole food, whether it's just the Hormel chicken from the grocery store or the whatever kind of beef they sell at Walmart. That's still going to be so much better for you than, you know, having the processed, I haven't eaten that kind of food in so long, but I don't even know what it would be called, but buying the ultra processed cheap food from the grocery store, just buy the generic stuff, because then one day you will be able to make those switches little by little. And another thing is the ruminant animals. So the animals that chew their cud, that would be deer or cow, lamb, buffalo, you know, all the different animals, the ruminant animals, those animals have a specific bacteria in their, first of all, they have several stomachs. So even if those animals are not 100% grass fed, if they do have some corn in their diet, some soy in their diet, the rumen in their stomach is able to break a lot of that down. So the fat from ruminant animals, even if it is from a feedlot animal, is going to be still, you're going to get a lot of nutrition from that food. Ideally, obviously, you want to support the local farmers and support the farmers that are raising the animals properly. But if you can't afford it, go buy the ground beef, go buy the chicken, go buy those whole ingredients and use them. And don't let that like hold you back from making good changes. Buy the non-organic produce. I don't buy everything organic. I couldn't afford to. But do what you can and focus on the whole foods and then learn to properly prepare them. And don't let that be like, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Just try to do what you can, you know, at the time of your life that you're at.
Yeah. What might somebody notice if they do start to make these changes for themselves? Like for myself, I love to know like the quality is there. And not eating those pasteurized things. Like we said, so many things have seed oils in them and whatnot these days. But I also notice like I've tried to completely cut out like additives like red dye and different things from my kids' diets. And I've noticed they're, you know, like they don't get as crazy. They're much more balanced, much more like energy wise throughout the day, they're much more balanced when they're eating healthy with me. Have you noticed anything like throughout your entire journey, kind of what your biggest things are is like when you've made these changes?
I would say mine has so much been focused the majority of the time on my digestion. So 100% I can tell when my digestion is off depending on if I'm traveling or eating certain things I wouldn't normally eat. But most recently, after my daughter Ruby was born 4 years ago now, or 3 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe 3.5. I struggled with postpartum depression. I had major hormone imbalances. And that's when I kind of took a deep dive into how diet affects your hormone health. And I started learning more about pro-metabolic eating and eating to support your hormones. And I would say that that would be the most recent shift that I've noticed personally, would be after my baby. Now he's almost two, but Dean, during his pregnancy and after his pregnancy, I really focused on nourishing myself and eating in a balanced way with carbs, protein, fat with every meal, every snack, waiting to have coffee until after food so you don't get that caffeine, you know, that caffeine hit and then the crash. It definitely makes a huge difference with your hormones if you are eating in a balanced way versus just eating healthy food. Because I was eating healthy food. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't supporting my body in the way that it needed. And so I did end up going to the Wellness Way, and they were a huge help. They were amazing. I went to the Iron Mountain office and worked with Dr. Laura, and that was what kind of kickstarted my journey through my postpartum depression and realizing how food can impact that. And it was a lot of emotional work as well, but food definitely played a role.
Yeah. So your biggest thing with the pro-metabolic or eating for hormone health is making sure you have a protein, fat, and carb with each meal. And
yeah. Yes. So I would say the focus would more be on protein than anything. I was greatly under eating protein. I ate a lot of carbs and was great at getting my fat in. I cook with a lot of fats, and that's such an easy thing to get in your diet when you are using good, healthy, delicious fats. But I was not focusing enough on my protein. So the shift was really focusing on protein and then having a balanced meal. So you're not having these blood sugar spikes and crashes. You're trying to like maintain as level of a blood sugar level as you can. And that I feel like I still like, I mean, it's a learning curve, and I've only been doing it for a couple of years now, but it makes a big difference with how you feel during the day. If I have coffee on an empty stomach, my hands start shaking. I get this bottled up energy. I feel anxious. It's such a bad feeling. And I still do that every once in a while. I just got an espresso machine. So, you know, every once in a while, I just can't help it but make a latte, and I pay for it. But it's good to be reminded, though, that it is important, you know, to focus on those things. But yeah, I would say that I guess that would be like the most recent shift would be in the past couple of years, really focusing on protein, fat, carbs. So you can have dessert, just have it after a meal. You know, you can have coffee, just have it after a meal. Make sure you're having focus on protein. For women in their menstruating years, it's very important to be eating within 30 minutes to an hour after you wake up. And if I've learned just through my own journey that if you don't wake up hungry, it's not a good sign. If you are in your menstruating years, you should be hungry when you wake up. A lot of people are running on cortisol, like I was for a very long time. You wake up in the morning, you're not hungry, your body is running on cortisol, and you really want to try to make those changes so your body can feel safe and not feel like it has to always be in this constant stressed state. Yeah. And I don't make a full-on breakfast in the first hour. Sometimes I'll just make a yolky milk drink, add some collagen to it. Sometimes I'll have some cottage cheese with berries. Sometimes I'll just have some Greek yogurt. So it just depends. And then I make breakfast, you know, a little bit later in the morning, but I do always try to have something within the hour of waking. And that does make a big difference with how my day goes.
Yeah. So with the blood sugar, we want to keep it at more of a balance instead of like these high spikes and crashes. So
yeah.
What I've learned along with you is that if you just are eating like carbs and sugar or even like people do a lot of like oatmeal and then sugar on it, or toast or a bagel and head out the door. Like you're having this cortisol or this blood sugar spike, and then you crash when you don't have the protein with it to stabilize your blood sugar for a long period of time. So if you still have the bagel, but if you put it with egg and cheese or something, you'll have a much more stable blood sugar until you eat again at lunchtime.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, if you have, say, some sugar or carbs on its own, it can affect you for up to 5 hours. You know, it's not just like this immediate spike and crash. It can affect you, you know, for several hours. So then if 5 hours later, you're having more carbs and not balancing it with some protein and fat, you know, it's just this constant up and down. And if you put in the effort to try to really focus on protein in each meal and let the others, it's easy to get carbs, it's easy to get fat, focus on the protein. If you do that for a couple of weeks and then go back to having carbs, carb heavy meals, you really, really notice the difference.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, it took trying it for a while and then going back to having, you know, just oatmeal for breakfast or different things. And my days didn't go as well or as smooth, or I didn't feel as well. I would want to take a nap, or maybe I'd be more stressed out and short with the kids. Everybody's impacted differently, but definitely has been a constant effort now, you know, knowing how much it can affect me.
Yeah. Are you intuitively just trying to like, okay, I have protein with each meal, or are you trying for a certain amount of grams per day or a mix of both?
I don't focus so much on numbers. And I know for some people that would work really well. And I think if people have had a healthy relationship with food, I think that's a good thing to focus on. For me, I counted my calories for so many years. I watched my fat intake for so many years. So I have not tracked how much protein at each meal, just because I feel like that would put me down an obsessive path.
Yeah.
But for somebody that has not struggled with that, I would encourage you to do that so you can be aware of what you are consuming. And a lot of people will be shocked at how much they're under eating protein. There's different ways out there that you can try to figure out how much you should have. Some people say half your body weight in grams. Other people just say, you know, focus on 100 grams per day. So it'd be 30 grams per meal. You just have to figure out what works for you. For me, I just focus on protein as being the star of the meal. Okay. And then I have some carbs, and my stuff is always cooked in fat, so I don't really have to worry about that. But that's just the way that I've done it, is if I have a meal, I take it meal by meal. You know, I don't really stress about the day as a whole. I just take it meal by meal and focus on my protein, and then I'll make my meal based around that.
Cool. Yeah, that's what I've heard too, kind of like 30 grams. And I think sometimes it's a good idea to know, because like two eggs is 12 grams. Like,
okay, yeah.
You know, like you could be eating four eggs and getting your 30 grams. And like, who says that we just have to have two eggs? I think that's another social thing we don't even realize we're doing.
Yeah.
And so so I, even when I started learning about this kind of stuff, I'm like, oh, I'll just up the amount of eggs I'm making and just have whatever else on the side. And I don't even really need a ton of else on the side. It might be a fruit or some bacon or something. But then you're getting all those grams of protein in. And like you said, you're probably cooking it in butter or something anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes so much easier. And then you're fuller for so much longer. I'm not snacking on just junk food all the time.
That is the biggest difference that I've noticed, aside from how I feel physically, is I am not hungry. And I used to snack all day long. And my kids would snack all day long if I fed them carb-heavy meals. And it definitely holds you over, and you feel a lot more satiated for a lot longer, and you don't have the cravings that come with, you know, that come with eating a lot of starches and sugars.
Yeah. This has been I think people are really going to enjoy this episode just because there's so much information to be had here. One last question I want to ask you before we start to wrap things up is, have you seen, like, for your kids, how has this change been like for them, or has this been all they've known?
This has largely been all they've known. My daughter Emerson I would have really started diving deep into the traditional eating when she was a little less than a year old, maybe.
Okay.
So she was, I guess, around a year when I started introducing a lot of these foods into my diet. My daughter Ruby and my son Dean, this is all they've known. Mm-hmm. But my daughter Emerson and Ruby both struggled with eczema. And so that has been a really cool experience. Obviously, it was not fun dealing with the eczema and the bleeding and the terrible skin. But it's been a really cool, it's been really cool to see how food can help heal that as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if people are familiar with Weston A. Price, but the Weston Price Foundation has so much information on their website. There's a book called Nourishing Traditions. There's a book for children, childhood diseases, pregnancy, and it's the it's a purple book. I can't remember exactly the name, but the childhood book for the children's book of Nourishing Traditions. And those books are, I would recommend everyone to purchase them. They're so full of information, how to properly prepare food. But that was kind of the route that I started taking when Emerson suffered from her eczema. And then Ruby, especially, she had it even worse. But yeah, started really focusing on the proper preparation and the animal foods, the animal-based diet, and figuring out what her triggers were for her eczema. It was ended up being grains. And for my daughter Emerson, it was sugar and dairy. That's when we started the raw dairy. So yeah, I would say if anyone out there has health issues, obviously there are so many things that go into figuring out, you know, what is causing them, but diet is a great place to start and kind of, could I say, a gateway into, you know, the natural world and how you can take control of your health. And I don't think we can ever stop learning. One person could never know it all, but the Weston Price Foundation is a wonderful place for somebody that is just starting out. Go look on westonprice.org. There's another website. I think it's, I don't know if you have a bio. Maybe I'll just have to give it to you to link in the bio, but it's Nourishing Our Children. And then there's three websites that have great information. And those books, the Nourishing Tradition books, are wonderful books. You don't have to read them start to finish. You can pick through them, look in the index, decide which chapter, you know, would resonate with you and just kind of bounce around in the books and learn from there.
Yeah, text me those links and then I'll just link them in the show notes. And then also, if you don't mind sending me a link for that apothecary page on YouTube too.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's perfect because I was just going to ask what you'd recommend as far as resources go. So that's amazing.
It's a great place to start. The Weston Price Foundation, they have everything from on their page, from obviously dietary recommendations and traditional preparation of food, but they also have links to, if you're looking for raw milk in your area, there's chapter leaders all over the country. They also have links to biological dentists. They have information. They have many blog posts of, you know, you can search anything on their page and find blog posts of people that have researched and looked deeper into those topics. So it's just, yeah, there's a wealth of information on there.
That's amazing. I haven't heard of that one, so I'm excited to go look at it myself.
Yeah.
And these books too. I'm always looking for more book recommendations.
Yeah. Yes. If you were to get one and you have children, I would definitely say get the children's book of Nourishing Traditions, the purple book.
Okay. Sounds good. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you want to add about anything that we talked about over the last hour or so?
I guess to summarize it, I would say for anyone that is either in the process of making changes to their diet or is just listening for the first time and this is brand new to them, is not to be intimidated by it and not overcomplicate it. It is very simple if you start learning about how all these foods have their place and learn the proper preparation. It really is an inclusive diet. But also, I would just say try one thing at a time. Like, so many people see my page and they're like, oh, I could never cook like that, or I could never cook a meal for you because you eat this way. I'm just a normal person and I have a passion, but I love all food.
Yeah.
But I would say people, they see the process and they get intimidated, and it's just picking one thing and just trying it. Like you said, the bone broth, you put bones in a pot, you cover it in water and you cook it. But you can find a blog post out there that overcomplicates it. Absolutely. Making sauerkraut, you take some cabbage, chop it up, add salt to it and massage it until it turns into a, it releases a brine, stick it in a glass jar, pound it down and let it sit for 2 weeks. A lot of these things are truly so simple, but you can find a lot of accounts that overcomplicate them. I would just say start one thing at a time and don't let the natural world, don't let my page intimidate you. Use it as a way to learn one thing at a time and try to be open-minded. It really does add a lot of excitement to your life when you start preparing things totally from scratch. And it for sure can add more stress if you fill your plate too much. Mm-hmm. But it really is a fun journey.
Yeah.
In the kitchen.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's just so rewarding. So rewarding. And we keep mentioning your page. So what's your Instagram handle?
Yeah. My Instagram page is Naturally Nourished Home. All lowercase, no punctuation or anything, just Naturally Nourished Home. And then, I mean, I'm not the greatest at making posts on there, but I share in my stories a lot because that's easy to do when I'm home and busy with the kids. But yeah, and feel free to reach out with any questions for anyone listening. I'm an open book with my health journey, and I don't know it all, but I can help you with what I've been through and what I've experienced and learned along the way. And yeah, it's
definitely,
yeah.
Yeah, it's inspiring to watch you. And now I'm like, oh, maybe I could get a beef tongue next time we get a cow.
Yeah, oh man, if you're to pick one organ, if I were to say one organ to try, looks the weirdest, but tastes the best. It's just a muscle. It's just a muscle. It's just a roast. That's all it is, except it has a lot more flavor. It's, you just got to get past the fact that you're peeling skin off of a tongue. Yeah. But if you are to get part of a cow and you're like, I don't know what to get the beef tongue and just get over that mental block and try it. And it is phenomenal.
All right. Well, we'll end with that. Thank you so much for hopping on. This was so fun to.
Yeah, thank you.
Share all your knowledge.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
And that, my friends, is a wrap on this episode of the Journey to Wellness podcast. I would love it if you could take the time to head over and give us a review on what you thought of this podcast. And if you have any questions or need to find anything, you can check out the show notes or you can send us a DM as well. We are so thankful you're here and we look forward to seeing you next time.